watch our universe expand and heroes fight crime. Ooh. Yeah. Ooh. Marvel by the month.
It's incredible.
Marvel by the month.
So mighty.
Marvel by the month.
Fantastic.
Marvel by the month.
Uncanny.
Ooh. Marvel by the month.
Hey, Merry Christmas, everyone. Welcome to Marvel by the Month. My name is Brian Stratton.
And I'm Rob Milne.
And if we have timed this right, this showed up in your podcast feed on Christmas Day, which is very exciting.
You're welcome.
hopefully you have better things to do than listen to us ramble on about comic books. But regardless of when you're listening to us, Merry Christmas, if Christmas is your thing, and Happy Holidays, whatever you celebrate. We hope 2019 is treating you nicely as it's winding down here. This is going to be our last episode of 2019.
Hooray.
Yeah. Thank you so much for listening to us this year. When we launched this thing in May, I don't think either one of us thought we would get 30-something episodes out and not miss a week. But here we are. So
yeah,
that's a pretty good accomplishment.
That I will take it. I will take any accomplishment for 2019.
Well, we're going to savor every little victory we can get. So this week's comics, they were all published with a cover date of September 1964. I think we're set up for what might be one of our very best episodes so far to end the year on. There's a ton of good stuff in here. We've got The Origin of Doctor Doom. We've got the first appearances of Kang the Conqueror, Hawkeye, and Diablo. We've got Spider-Man meeting Daredevil for the first time. And the epic returns of Pastepot Pete and the Human Top in 1 month.
Yeah, it's too big of a month. It's too big.
It really is. And wait, there's more. If that's not enough for you, our friend Joe Keating is back in the studio with us. Hey, Joe.
Hello. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Thank you. Joe, of course, is the writer of Shudder, Ringside, Glory, Evolution, and so much more good stuff. And Joe, you also recently announced something very exciting.
Oh, yeah. I'm making my debut in Heavy Metal Magazine now. It's happening. Like
it's already happened.
Your timeline. Yeah. It's already happened.
This is King the Conqueror stuff. It gets really confusing.
Oh, man. And Ram a Tut. Can we get to that?
Oh, he's also in this month. Yeah.
It's such a wacky month. Anyway, yeah, no, I, you know, Heavy Metal was one of those comics that's just in my lifeblood. And I edited an anthology years ago called Pop Gun, and the two lodestars for that were Raw and Heavy Metal.
Yeah.
And so I did a Megadeth thing for Heavy Metal this year. It was this big old anthology, Death by Design, this is awesome, because I got to do a Megadeth story, which is the fastest yes I ever get, but the only yes that may have gone even faster was when they asked me to do the magazine. And it's a trip because they do these themed issues,
uh-huh,
and it's all street art, and so it's a bunch of graffiti artists drawing comics.
That is so rad.
And listeners of this podcast will appreciate that. I was okay, what's the best way to like segue another medium into comics? And I was like, we got to get Farron Delgado, because he letters like Artie Simek. And it's such a cool, weird fusion of stuff. And so it's like the Simek-y graffiti art. I mean, it was a blast to work on. To have that in my first Heavy Metal thing, it's pretty sweet. And I loved working with them, so I think we got some other stuff cooking.
Oh, yeah. Very nice. Cool. Very cool.
Yeah, I saw the teaser from Heavy Metal and in Instagram and other things, just some of the postings as well.
It's an insane issue. The Shepherd Fairey's in there. I mean, also, I worked with Nick Walker, who's amazing.
That's wild. That's good company.
It's insane. So I'm very grateful.
And nice. I still love Megadeth, even though, you know, I might not agree with Dave Mustaine all the time in his politics. I don't follow him on Facebook anymore, but I do love them.
I have to admit, Heavy Metal's been great and also a heartbreaker, because they've asked me twice if I was going to be at cons that he would be at to sign with him.
Oh, man.
I honestly really, because one of them was Chicago, and I was like, maybe I should just fly myself. I didn't do it.
But if
that comes up again, a third time, I can't say. Heavy Metal set that up.
Man, Megadeth was my very first concert that I ever went to.
Oh,
yeah. It was Suicidal Tendencies opening for Megadeth.
Wow. Yeah. Where was that?
In Burlington, Vermont in like 1992, 93. Yeah.
Wow.
So
now that's a show.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah.
fully beats whatever Motley Crue Theater of Pain or something. I was so, my parents dropped us off. It was a, I mean, it was fine. It was great. Sure. But I, you know, I saw Metallica at a small club and during Master of Puppets tour later that year. So it was much cooler.
We've got a ton of great stuff to get into. If I know us, we're going to go off on a million tangents, which is the point of this thing.
Ever since you've been on, we've been going off on more tangents.
Yeah, I think you
love it.
You brought inspired. It into the studio.
Yeah, I love it. Anytime.
So, let's jump right in. Let's do a little bit of historical context.
We'll travel back in time. Like, let's say Kang the Conqueror.
Oh, yeah. And, or some sort of Pharaoh Ramatut. All these comics were cover dated September 1964. That means that they were hitting newsstands in July 1964. Here's some of what was happening in the world. Rob, do you want to start us out with a little bit of civil rights updates?
So on the 2nd, the biggest story of the month is that U.S. President Lyndon Baines Johnson, I can't not say Baines, signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964 into law, abolishing racial segregation in the United States. Virtually all opposition in the House of Representatives came from, guess what, Republicans and Deep South Democrats. The law took effect at 6:45 p.m. Eastern Time when President Johnson signed the bill, commenting that years ago I realized a sad truth. To the extent that black people were imprisoned by racial segregation, so was I. That's pretty good.
That's it's kind of a stunning thing to hear a president, a white president, say, for a couple reasons. So one of them, I think, is a really good expression of it, where he's, you know, recognizing that by being segregationist, white people were hurting themselves badly as well, whether they knew it or not. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I'm not quite sure that he was as imprisoned by racial segregation as black people
like,
were. But
literally not, but yeah.
But, you know, I
the sentiment,
the heart
awesome.
Is in the right place. Yeah, exactly.
So that new law was put to the test immediately by black citizens in several previously segregated cities. And while there were tremendous tensions and vocal protests by white racists, they were generally provided with the service they were entitled to, however grudgingly.
Yep. It actually, for at least the first few days, everything went along pretty smoothly.
Yeah.
Then
what?
It doesn't really last, but then we go to the 9th of July. So in Alabama, Circuit Judge James Hare issued an injunction that almost destroyed Alabama's civil rights movement. He prohibited three or more members of organizations favoring or opposing civil rights from gathering together. So the idea was these types of gatherings are just powder kegs, regardless of, you know, which side of it you're on. So to ensure public safety, that was his fig leaf justification. It's like no one gets to assemble for that purpose. Mass meetings and rallies disappeared in Alabama and voter applications declined to their lowest number in years. Daniel H. Thomas, the federal judge whose district included Judge Hare's circuit, would delay a ruling on a motion to dismiss the injunction until 1965. So the whole reason for this was to prevent black people from registering to vote before the 64 election. Mm-hmm. And it did its job.
It worked in Alabama, right? On the 11th, Lemuel A. Penn, an African-American who was the assistant superintendent of the Washington, D.C. public schools and a lieutenant colonel in the United States Army Reserve, was shot and killed by two Klansmen while on his way back to Washington from annual training in Fort Benning in Georgia. The two men, Howard Sims and Cecil Myers, would be acquitted of murder by an all-white jury in spite of a signed confession. In 1966, the two killers would become the first people tried in federal court under the new Civil Rights Act of 1964 for the crime of violating a person's civil rights. Each would serve 6 years in prison for the killing.
Which is a ridiculously lenient punishment, but before the Civil Rights Act, there would have been no punishment.
Yeah.
We got to break this up with some good news. So on the 16th of July, Freedom Day proceedings were held throughout Mississippi by the SNCC as part of a project to transport African Americans to the courthouse to register to vote under the protection of the new Civil Rights Act. By August 2nd, more than 500,000 African American citizens had been added to the voter registration list. So the Civil Rights Act is doing its job.
Yes, and On the 16th of July,
same day,
NYPD officer Thomas Gilligan shot and killed 15-year-old James Powell in Harlem.
Yeah.
On the 18th, 6 days of rioting began when a crowd of 4,000 protesters assembled outside the Harlem Precinct Police Station. When the protest leaders were arrested by NYPD officers, other members of the crowd began throwing bricks and Molotov cocktails at the station, and others began vandalizing and looting neighborhood businesses and office buildings. Over the next 6 days, 140 people were injured and one died. 520 people were arrested and over 500 structures were destroyed. The outbreak was followed for the first time in the United States in the 20th century by a chain reaction of riots that would strike seven other major American cities for the next 6 weeks.
I remember my folks telling me about the riots in the 60s. And this is like the start of them. This isn't the end of them, but, and just like what an incredibly turbulent time it was, like between assassinations and riots and everything else, and protests. And, it was a pretty intense time to be in America. And then, just one more, thing to mention on the 23rd, this again is a bit of Civil Rights Act news. Three white employees of a plumbing firm in Greenwood, Mississippi, became the first persons to be arrested under the new Civil Rights Act and were criminally charged with violating the civil rights of an African-American man when they beat him up for trying to enter a local movie theater. If you know anyone who takes the position, yes, slavery was terrible, segregation was terrible, but we passed laws to get rid of all that, and I don't understand what everyone's still upset about. It's like, yeah, you can pass laws, but, you know, just because a law is on the books doesn't mean a person is not going to break that law. So,
well, in Vietnam news,
let's just front load all the bad news.
On the 3rd of July, a group of demonstrators organized by pacifist David Dellinger stood outside the White House and conducted the first American public protest against U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War. On the 6th, the Battle of Nam Dong, the first in the Vietnam War to have numerous American casualties, began at 2:26 in the morning in South Vietnam when an 800-man contingent of the Viet Cong began firing mortar rounds at a South Vietnamese army camp near South Vietnam's border with Laos. When the battle ended by dawn, 53 South Vietnamese, two Americans, and an Australian soldier were dead.
So that's heating up.
Yep.
Yeah, that news gets a lot worse before it gets any better. Little Cold War information. On the 15th of July, Leonid Brezhnev, Lenny Bruce and Lester Banks, birthday party, cheesecake, jelly bean, boo, stepped down from the ceremonial job of head of state of the Soviet Union at the request of Prime Minister and Communist Party First Secretary Nikita Khrushchev. The shuffling of positions led Western observers to conclude that Brezhnev was being prepared as Khrushchev's eventual successor, something which would happen 3 months later. So,
correct. Right.
Khrushchev will start disappearing from Marvel Comics, and Brezhnev will start showing up.
Hooray.
Yeah.
What in pop culture we have on July 4th, so American, the Beach Boys' I Get Around reached number one on the Billboard's charts.
Taking it back from those filthy Brits.
Yeah. So those, like, I'm guessing some of those, like 60% or whatever we said last month, of all the singles in the U.S. that were sold by the Beatles started to inch back a little bit towards the Beach Boys.
Right. Do you think that there was like a thumb on the scale just to make sure that the number one album on July 4th was not going to be the Beatles?
Probably.
I mean, it seems plausible. I don't know.
On the 6th, the Beatles, their first feature film, A Hard Day's Night, premiered in the United Kingdom at the London Pavilion. It would be released in the United States on August 11th. The movie soundtrack would be released on July 10th in the UK.
And then our final little bit of context for what was going on in July 1964. This one is particularly relevant. On the 27th of July, the first recorded official comic book convention took place in 1964 in New York City. It was known as New York Comic-Con. The one-day convention was held at the Workman's Circle Building and was organized by 16-year-old Bernie Bubness and fellow enthusiast Ron Fradkin. Official guests of the Tri-State Con included Steve Ditko, Flo Steinberg, and Tom Gill, with over 100 attendees reported, including future Game of Thrones author George R.R. Martin.
That's some cred.
Yeah.
First Comic-Con.
when I was 16, I organized a comic book convention in my hometown, and I believe we also had approximately 100 attendees. So I was just, you know, I did it 30 years later, but
I luckily lived here, so
yeah,
our comic cons had up to like 500 people in the like side wing of the Memorial Coliseum.
Right. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, those were good shows, man.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I like those.
I remember buying up all the Alpha Flight t-shirts when that was the time. And I really, really was into Alpha Flight.
John Byrne would be proud, I guess.
Just always rooted for the underdog. Like Moon Knight. Sure. We were talking about Moon Knight. It's just like off-brand crazy Batman. Yeah. Crazier Batman.
Much crazier Batman. Cool. Well, that's what was going on in July 1964 when these issues were hitting the stands. We're going to take our first break, and when we come back, it's Rob's turn in the hot seat for Marvel by the Minute here on Marvel by the Month. Okay, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. It's time for Marvel by the Minute. Marvel published too many comics each month for us to talk about each of them in depth. We're going to go deep on three of them later on in the episode. Everything else winds up in this blood pressure raising bit of fun we call Marvel by the Minute. Now, what we usually do is we give Rob 60 seconds to summarize each issue, and then we move on to the next one. But Rob, it's Christmas, and, you know, we joke about this, but this is a legitimately nerve-wracking thing. Like, you do get like the flop sweats when you do this.
I turn red. Yeah. I get sweatier and sweatier. It's like,
And, you know, it's like as much fun as that is to just see week after week and subject you to, I feel a little bit weird just giving you 60 seconds to talk about each issue on Christmas. So because it's Christmas, we're going to do something a little different this time. You're going to have a minute and 5 seconds for each issue.
Such a gift.
Yeah, you're welcome. So hopefully that's going to take a little bit of the pressure off.
Yeah.
And Joe, if you want to jump in here and tag in, help him out, go for it. And if not, you know, that's fine too.
Yeah, so. I'm also happy to totally derail about one panel. You know, as you know.
So let's go ahead and start out with Fantastic Four number 30. This is The Dreaded Diablo, written by Stan Lee, with art by Jack Kirby, inked by Chick Stone. And this is the first appearance of Diablo, who is a master alchemist who's been imprisoned for 100 years.
Thankfully, that's a lot of what I was going to say.
There you go.
Yeah, I was going to ask, so what's the Marvel by the Minute about this time around? Because that's about the gist of it.
So we have a minute and 5 seconds on the clock.
Luxury.
Go for it.
Okay, well, the FF is on vacation for some reason near Transylvania. They end up getting kind of lost in some spooky woods and stay the night in a giant weird castle. They end up with the Thing getting taken in or like mind possessed in his dream by some by Diablo, who has him break him out of his crypt thing. Then Diablo gives him some potion that makes him like half person.
A handsome thing.
Yeah, yeah. Handsome thing.
Yeah, he's like less bumpy, but he's still orange and craggly. He thinks it's great. He then works for Diablo to mess with the rest of the Fantastic Four. It gets really crazy. I don't remember exactly what Diablo does next, but he threatens a bunch of people.
Well, yeah, he cons the world thinking his potions actually do what he says they're going to do, and then they don't work. This is the worst con ever. It lasts about 30 seconds.
So Diablo, I was surprised, remained a villain.
You know, it's funny. So I was a big, well, still am a big Eric Larson fan.
Oh, yeah.
And then when, unfortunately, when he was working on Revenge of Sinister Six, and the sad reality is his house burned down, so he's like, guys, I can't do a whole issue.
Oh, man.
Because I don't know that, right? Because I'm 10. I don't know what's going on. The internet was in its nascent stages. All I knew was I only got about like 10 pages of Larson, and then there was this Diablo backup that was done at the last minute by who knows. And I just have this adverse reaction to Diablo now. I can't. It's not fair.
Yeah.
Because the idea is cool. He's an alchemist.
Right.
But like for an alchemist, who's none of his things work except he's immortal.
Right? Yeah.
So that
works.
So something's going on.
Yeah. You just plan ahead. Put some money in savings.
A couple things I wanted to mention is one, we kind of glossed over that. So the FF is historically broke, right? They're nonprofit. They don't have a lot of money. And so whatever money they save, they're like, guys, let's go to Transylvania. You know,
I don't know. Maybe the exchange rate was really favorable.
That's true. That's true. And then let's get lost in the woods.
Yeah.
The other part is this is one of two comics. I forget what the other one is. I do have it noted where the credit to the letterers really mean.
Oh, yeah.
Like, yeah. Like
the credit to Stan Lee, of course, is a rather nice writer.
Yep.
A quite noteworthy artist for Jack Kirby. Chick Stone, a somewhat nifty inker, which is Aggret, and then Art Simek, who's one of the best letterers of all time, an occasionally neat letterer. And as I recall, the other one's even worse. I figured it's him or Sam Rosen, but we'll get to it, I guess, in a bit.
Well, I think we were talking about this an episode or two ago. I can't remember if it actually made it into the edit or not, but so, like, Stan, he had started doing this in the credits, and, like, it would always be, like, compliment, 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 insult the letterer.
Yeah.
And at some point, I think, like, he legitimately got on someone's
letter,
like, because then that's when he, like, he created Irving Forbush.
Right.
And then Irving Forbush becomes the joke.
But I mean, could you imagine being Art Simek and you're trying to do this book as beautiful as possible within 24 hours or how much time you have, and you have to write out the letters that you're a loser? You know, come on,
that's
man.
Cruel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's cruel and unusual.
Okay, Rob, that was pretty good. We're going to move on to Amazing Spider-Man number 16. This one is called Duel with Daredevil, written by Stan Lee, with art by Steve Ditko. It's the first meeting between Spider-Man and Daredevil, and they take on the Ringmaster and his circus of crime.
I gotta say, on the cover, has one of my favorite cover blurb warnings I think I've ever seen on a Marvel comic.
Uh-huh.
Warning, if you don't say this is one of the greatest issues you've ever read, we may never talk to you again. Can you imagine you're 8 and you don't get that it's not like a real thing, like a real promise? And you're like, ugh, I better like this Ringmaster appearance. Yeah. That's pressure, man.
Yep, and it does also continue Stan's streak of portraying all Carnival employees as trash. We've never had a positive portrayal of anyone who works at a circus.
Oh, and to your point, the Sam Rosen credit on here is a compliment.
Uh-huh.
It's Sultan of Sparkling Spelling. So maybe Sam was like, okay, really? Yeah. I got to do all this?
Like,
and then,
it's like, Stan, I'm going to punch you in the face if you make me do one more of these. Okay, you got 65 seconds on the clock.
Yeah.
And go.
Okay, we start off with Matt Murdock, blind lawyer, wandering through the streets, almost getting mugged. He could probably take care of it, but Spider-Man jumps in. He knows he's there. He takes care of it. So they have a light meeting. Then the Foggy and Karen are trying to get Matt to go to the circus. And he's like, that's just mean. All you do is smell like elephant dung and whatever.
The circus is a big deal, though, in this comic book.
Oh, yeah.
When Betty Brant does not get invited, she is devastated.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So, it turns out Ringmaster's there. He's got a big plan. His plan is he's going to advertise that Spider-Man's going to be at the circus so that more people will come. But, you know, Spider-Man gets word of this and then goes to the circus. He thinks he's doing some stuff for charity, but then Ringmaster hypnotizes everybody, including Spider-Man. But he can't hypnotize Matt Murdock because he's blind. So Daredevil fights Spider-Man. And I don't even remember how it turns out, but Ringmaster's hat is pretty weird. It is some kind of gizmo that causes hypnotism.
Yeah.
Also, what was the scam? Were they going to, like, pickpocket everybody?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's hypnotize everyone and pickpocket
them. It's a little
unclear.
They're just like, let's hypnotize them, and then, I don't know. We'll figure that out when we get there.
We'll take embarrassing photos. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. Let's go on to our next one. X-Men number 7, The Return of the Blob.
With all the words spelled right by Art Simek. We should just read these every time. None of the other ones that
and
are
so
glowing.
So then Art Simek sees all the Sam Rosen ones, which are all glowing. He's like, what the heck?
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
This one, it's like it says on the cover and in the title, it's X-Men versus the Blob, who for the first time is teaming up with the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, who apparently just had a contract to appear in like every issue of X-Men for the first 20 issues. They're still here, and the Blob is back with them. And the cover teases that in this jam-packed issue, you will meet the X-Men's new leader. 65 seconds on the clock. Go for it.
The new leader is Scott. Didn't want anyone to have to hold their breath. The cool part is we get to see Cerebro the first time, and it is insane. It's like, it looks like a tinker toy, I don't know, it robot octopus of wires everywhere.
Like a weird Goldberg thing.
Yeah. Very, very Kirby. Basically, this is the same kind of plot as when the evil mutants are trying to recruit Namor. Now they're trying to recruit the Blob, so the X-Men go there. They try to recruit the Blob. We see some more cool Blob powers, I guess. But Magneto also has this like telekinetic. He can do more with his brain than we've previously understood.
Yes.
And he does. It's a good, you know, putting Magneto over with his powers. But we also realize how good Scarlet Witch is, and again, more of the bond of Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch.
That about did it, man.
Yeah, I mean that's pretty much it. And I think the partnership between Blob and the Brotherhood doesn't work out because Magneto fires missiles at the X-Men. And they hide behind the Blob, and he gets blown up instead. That old
saw. And the Blob just wants to be a carny. Yeah, like that's what he says.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. Oh yeah, and you know, it's yet another issue where everyone in the circus is just criminal trash.
One big thing though, Professor X isn't there to solve Deus Ex Machina the thing.
I will say it's pretty interesting, especially in this era, that the whole concept of series has changed already, which I guess they're actually doing quite a bit when stuff wasn't selling.
Right.
But
they just tweak it.
Yeah, you know, my favorite scene, though, I gotta say, was when they're in the Greenwich Village Beat Nick bar.
Yes.
And for some reason, I guess because he has giant feet, that the Beast becomes their new god, essentially.
What did they call him?
Yeah, how did you like that panel, Rob?
Oh, when they're painting like the face on the bottom of his foot, too?
Yeah, there's a lot of foot stuff in this one.
You know, I'm growing as far as how much foot stuff I can stomach, but still not my thing.
That whole scene was really funny to me because, you know, Stan gets a deserved reputation for, you know, making comics, you know, hipper and more relevant to, you know, a slightly older demographic and to youth culture of the time. But there is like a lot of the jokes are sort of at the expense of of the whole like Greenwich Village culture. So he is still like a 40-year-old man.
Right. Like, lives in Manhattan and is like these damn kids.
Exactly.
Just trying his best to get the slang right.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. But he's also, you know, writing for generally like 8 to 14-year-olds who live in the Midwest or all over the country. So there's not a lot of actual beats who are going to be offended by this. So maybe that was the right move. I mean, it seemed to have worked out well for him. Journey into Mystery number 108. We have two stories here. At the Mercy of Loki, Prince of Evil, written by Stan Lee, art by Jack Kirby with Chick Stone, and Tales of Asgard, Trapped by the Trolls, written by Stan Lee, art by Jack Kirby, inked by Vince Coletta. All right, 65 seconds on the clock, and go.
Okay, so this, we have Thor doing some Thor stuff. I can't remember exactly why, but he ends up saving Doctor Strange, who just got in a big fight with Mordo. He senses it somehow, and then he has doing an operation on Doctor Strange as lame Dr. Blake, and in the middle of the operation, Odin's like, hey Thor, I need you to come fight some stuff with me, and he's like, can't. So Odin gets mad. Loki takes advantage of that moment to become a bee and sneak by Heimdall, who we already learned could probably detect that. Doctor Strange then assists Thor with Loki, who's doing his normal havoc wreaking by using his astral form while he's in a wheelchair recovering. I think that's as much as I'm going to cover there. Then we get to the trolls. we get Thor in a very weird blonde fur suit who ends up getting enslaved by the trolls. But he brought his hammer in a sack because now he has the hammer, and he gets everybody out.
I gotta say, this may be one of my, the Trapped by the Troll story, maybe one of my favorite Vinnie Coletta ink jobs.
Yeah,
on Kirby.
It's cool.
It's pretty stellar.
It's the line work on the trolls is really good. And even like as weird as the blonde fursuit is, like it's really it's inked really nicely. Like, yeah, there's a lot of really fine line work on it.
Yeah, yeah. This month has not only, I think, one of any Coletta's best inking jobs on Kirby in this, but also, we'll get to it later, Chick Stone's best inking job. And, you know, I don't have it marked, but I do have it marked, like, which page specifically, but there is a Beatles reference in this issue.
Oh, yeah.
You were maybe expecting the Beatles? Like, what? No, what?
Yeah, the Avengers are rushing out to help Thor, and Thor's like, I've got this yeah, is very personal.
You know, I'm glad they did it, because it does bug me in certain comics, and I'm like, why wouldn't the Avengers just show up?
Right.
You know, especially like in the Marvel movies now, it does get a little like, wait, hold on.
Yeah.
Can you just call, you have Tony Stark's phone number?
Right. Anymore, like,
but yeah, it's like a universal threat going on right now.
Yeah.
You get everybody on the horn.
And so I really like that. They're like, hey, we're here to save the day. And he's like, yeah. I got this. You're not the Beatles.
It's a family thing. Yeah.
It's a family deal.
All right. Okay, Rob, this one, you'll have to do some tiptoeing around this one.
Yeah.
Sergeant Fury number 10. On to Okinawa, written by Stan Lee, with art by Dick Ayers, inked by George Bell. The Howling Commandos head to Okinawa in their first Pacific Theater action. I'll just say, this is, if you are reading along at home and you have not read this yet, it is very of its era. So the Japanese soldiers are featured prominently, and they are identified only by the first syllable of Japanese for most of the issue.
Yeah.
And like it's like every page. So just be prepared for that if you're going to take a dive into it.
Yeah, it's rough.
Yeah.
I'm not going there.
Okay. 65 seconds and go.
So we learned that there is a corporal, I think, who is infiltrated behind enemy lines on Okinawa, by dressing up as, he also speaks Japanese, but by dressing up as some Japanese commander. And so the Howlers are sent on an insane cross world flight, and a number of flights with like air fueling happening and landing a giant plane on an aircraft carrier. All of that seemed pretty cool. And then they're shot out of the torpedo tubes of a submarine to actually get past the boats guarding Okinawa to get on shore.
Yeah.
Then Izzy Cohen has to dress up again to impersonate an officer of the Japanese forces to get into the camp. He has to pretend his mouth has been injured, and they end up getting everybody freed and getting out before the island is bombed.
Yeah.
By the Allies.
That's about as much detail as you can get into with this one.
I glossed right over all of the rest of that.
Yeah. It's of its era.
I do. One of my favorite things in this issue, probably the thing I liked about this issue, is at the very end, the last caption, where they apologize for ending out in a romantic scene. Cause hey, this is a war comic, not a romance comic.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I also noted that the sergeant's name that was captured was Phil Parker. And I was like, oh, there's gotta be some like Mark Wayne comic where they use that to connect him to Kurt Busiek, to connect him to the Parker.
And he's called Pillbox Parker.
That's right.
Too. Yeah.
Pillbox Parker. Okay. Only two to go.
Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah. You're on the downhill. And I do mean downhill, because the next issue is Strange Tales 124. It's just called Pacepot Pete.
I can't believe that his outfit somehow got in some ways more ridiculous than his Rembrandt outfit.
And I gotta say, it's a real joy to read these with you guys, but that was the one where I was like, gag. I'm skipping over this.
Yeah. So this is Human Torch and Thing versus Pacepot Pete. And I believe at the end of the issue, we learn that Human Torch and Thing are both going to be starring in Strange Tales going forward.
A team up from now on.
Right. And then there's a Doctor Strange backup story, The Lady from Nowhere.
That was cool.
That was a good one. Yeah. Written by Stan Lee, art by Steve Ditko.
It's written by Steve Ditko, guys.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Come on.
Stan may have gone back and filled in the word balloons.
Stan tried to figure it out and write words to it later.
Yeah. My position on Stan has softened over the years, but when it comes to this Steve Ditko stuff, like Doctor Strange, that was turned in.
Yes.
I was ready to go.
Yep. Yeah. He just had a stack of those on his desk. okay, so are you ready to take us back to the man, the myth, the legend,
Paste Pot. Sure.
Okay.
We'll make that one brief and try to talk more about Doctor Strange.
Sounds good. 65 seconds and go.
So we get the front right from the get-go. The normal boys are fighting Ben and Johnny. Paste Pot Pete is now. they even show his old costume, but he's got a new thing. It's like a big purple vest full of paste that he can stick a little tube on and shoot paste at people. Man, and he basically got out early for good behavior when he helped that whole adhesive X problem with Baron Zemo.
Good continuity
dissolving. So they are referencing, cross referencing still quite a bit. He ends up pasting thing to the wall, and thing can't get off the wall until he realizes he can break the wall with Johnny's help, Johnny's brilliant help. Anyway, Doctor Strange. The lady, this is Doctor Strange trying to solve sort of a ghost mystery. And now I'm starting to blank out, so any help is welcome. I do remember he's trapped in like a light tube in his astral form for a while. And he basically tricks this guy, Zolta, into getting his hand in the way. That yes. one really fell apart.
And and the ghost is this mysterious woman. And once Doctor Strange defeats Zolta, he discovers that the woman is Cleopatra.
Yeah.
Yep. And is this the third time she's shown up in a Marvel comic?
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, it's at least the second. I think she might have been referenced even more than three times.
Yeah.
So I will say, one to give that, you know, give a little love to that Human Torch story. I thought that, and we'll get to it later, the Giant Man and the Hulk. But I thought this was a cool way to introduce, like, okay, now this guy's going to be in this from now on. Like,
yes.
Thing is going to be starring in this. But it did feel pretty natural, all things considered.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it wasn't, he's a shoehorn in here.
Right.
But it was, hey, the guy's pretty cool, right? All right, now we're going to feature him on the regular.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yet again, man, those Ditko, Doctor Strange is like primetime Marvel for me.
So good. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is, you know, one of my favorite, my second favorite comic of the month. My favorite. Should be obvious to anyone who's talking to me for 10 seconds.
Yeah. It's Tales to Astonish number 59. Enter the Hulk, written by Stan Lee, art by Dick Ayers, with Paul Reinman doing the inks. We have Giant Man and the Wasp versus the Hulk, secretly versus the Human Top, who's no longer wearing his costume, which is the best part of the Human Top.
It's just a guy spinning. Like, that's it now. That's it. That's the Human Top.
That's the Human Top.
I don't even remember what happens in this, so all help is welcome.
Okay.
65
seconds. Take it away.
I know we start off with Giant Man lifting some weights with the Avengers I'm looking at it.
They're working out, and there's a news feed. It was like, hey, the Hulk existed. And then Giant Man was like, oh, yeah, remember that guy used to hang out with us? I wonder what happened to him.
I feel bad for him.
Yeah. And then they go outside, and then the Human Top is reading three separate newspapers that all have cover stories on Giant Man, which I'm like, come on, guys.
That's not going to happen.
And then he's mad because of whatever. My favorite panel in this is on page 3, panel 4, where they're Wasp and Giant Man are walking down the street, and Giant Man is wearing a trench coat and a hat, but his full costume.
Yes.
And these kids, Yancey Street kids, wherever they're from, are calling him a square. I'm like, if I saw a guy dressed like that, I'd stay out of his way.
Get on the other side of the
side of the road. But, yeah, nothing much really happens in there. The Hulk shows up, and they fight for a while. But then they announce at the end that the Hulk will now be co-featured in Joker's Town.
Yes. For some reason.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's going to be the backup story going forward.
I do remember there were a couple times where Giant Man did something in these comics. I know we'll get to some of it, but it just seemed weird. Like, he really solved some problems.
Yeah, this month. Very unlike him.
Usually he just sort of bumbles and somehow it resolves.
I think one of my favorite bits of this issue, if I remember, they leave Avengers HQ and Wasp thinks that Hank's going to take her out to dinner. And then he says, forget about dinner for now. we're taking a trip instead. We'll eat on the plane. And he's just like decided that the two of them are going to fly to New Mexico to go track down the Hulk. And, you know, doesn't actually give her any say in
which it. I'm not quite clear why he wants to track down the Hulk.
He's just feeling bad for him. I think that's all he says it a couple of times.
Christmas
like,
is here. And
yeah,
now.
Right. Yeah. And, this is also the first issue where Banner turns into the Hulk because of stress. Yeah.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Yep. He's angry.
Yeah.
His blood pressure is rising and he's losing control.
Yeah. Well, and your blood pressure now should be falling because you've made it, it through is. Another installment of Marvel by the Minute.
I'm de-hulking. I'm wearing a Hulk t-shirt, but I am de-hulking.
That's wonderful. So good job.
Good job, Joe. Thank you.
Oh, no problem.
Excellent
saved
team
me
effort.
On that one.
We'll take another break. And when we come back, we'll start talking about the first appearance of Hawkeye. So don't go anywhere. Hey, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. It's time to talk about Tales of Suspense number 57. This story is called Hawkeye the Marksman. It's written by Stan Lee with art by Don Heck. And this is the first appearance of Hawkeye. And he teams up with the Black Widow to give Iron Man a hard time. I thought this is a pretty interesting issue to take a deep dive on because obviously Hawkeye has become a pretty pivotal character in the Marvel Universe. He was one of the founding Avengers in the Cinematic Universe. Not all that long ago, Matt Fraction had a just mind-blowing run on Hawkeye that mm-hmm. really kind of reestablished him as a major, major character.
David Aja.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. So first thing I got to say, though, is the cover of this issue, Iron Man's in the center of it in a big explosive splash effect. And then there's four images of Hawkeye surrounding him. And I think these are literally just cut and pasted from interior art.
That's what it looks like. Yeah,
they just didn't have time to like put an actual cover together. And
yeah,
so,
and most of the background is white, which is pretty rare on a Marvel comic or any comic. But yeah.
Yeah, and there's a blur that says, "We think Hawkeye is so terrific, we plastered him all over our cover."
I mean, this is now they're up to what, 10 books a month?
Yeah, yeah, something like that. 9 or 10, yeah.
With the annual this month, it's 10. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe that's just the increased workloads. We just gotta get it out.
Yep.
Yeah, because they've only got what, like maybe four or five full timers like working in that bullpen, and then you've got guys who are also moonlighting for other companies.
Oh,
and,
sure.
Yeah. So.
Well, I mean, even then, like the bullpen as we think of it doesn't really exist. So really, the office is what Stanley and Flo Steinberg.
Right.
And it's like we just gotta get this done. You know.
Yep.
You know. So, but speaking of artists, man. I gotta say, doing these rereads with you guys has given me a new appreciation for Don Heck.
Yeah.
I think his stuff is just gorgeous. And it actually teams up really well with Sam Rose. And it has I mentioned this last time, but a sort of a Kniff and a little bit of a Toth look to it, mm-hmm. you know? And mm-hmm. I feel like this guy was born to draw Iron Man and really doesn't get, you know, I mean, I would like love an artist edition of this stuff.
Yeah.
If it existed, you know, the art still exists.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, yeah, no, it's gorgeous. I mean, the way he conveys emotion and just people in general and, you know, it's fantastic stuff.
Yeah. I remember reading like, you know, Marvel Masterworks collections of Avengers back in the day after Heck takes over from Kirby. And I remember when I was younger being really annoyed. You promised me Kirby and now I'm getting Heck, you know. and I do think Heck, he suffered from the fact that he was the Marvel artist in the early 60s who wasn't Ditko and wasn't Kirby.
Right.
You know, it's like, mm-hmm. well, I mean, they're going to suck all the air out of the room, right? So, but yeah, like definitely going back and reading especially his Iron Man work, I was surprised by how much I liked his art in Iron Man.
I mean, I'll say it now. I mean, granted, one of the comics to come is one of my favorite Marvel comics of all time.
Yeah.
But this really is, I think, my favorite art of the month. I could read him doing Iron Man or Spy comics all day long.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He really kills at it.
It's very clean, too. Yeah. Like, his normal people are very emotive, too. Sometimes that's like a punt for, I mean, even Kirby. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, he's like the action and the costumes and the powered people,
right?
Like those are always big, and then sometimes the just sort of normal interactions are a little less,
right?
Yeah. the only thing I'll say about Heck's art on Iron Man is the only thing I don't like is the way that he draws Iron Man when he's in flight, where he just constantly looks like he's about to belly flop into the water.
He's having trouble.
But it's like, I mean, I think that was also no one really knew how to draw a really good flying hero. Like,
I mean, you got to remember, especially with this stuff, you're inventing it as they go along.
Exactly. Right.
You know, there's not 80 years worth of Iron Man comics to draw from.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Totally. Totally. But yeah, and he does a lot of varied scenes in this one. So like it starts out with Tony Stark taking Pepper Potts on a date to Coney Island.
On accident.
Yes.
Happy Hogan asked, which is a weird way to do it, asked his boss to ask his secretary to go out on a date.
Asked Iron Man to ask his boss.
Oh, dang, you're right.
Yeah, so he's like, he's trying to play this weird game of telephone. Like,
oh, man, that's even more bizarre.
Yeah. And so, like, through hilarious misunderstandings, Pepper thinks that Tony's asking her to go on a date, and Tony's like, yeah, let's go to Coney Island because I don't really want to, like, get anything started here. So what's the least romantic place I can go? Coney Island. I know a lot of people who were teenagers in New York in the 1960s who would not have thought that was the least romantic place to go. But, you know, this is Tony Stark we're talking about here.
He's got some money to throw around. Yeah.
Right.
Yet again, going to go into a circus type atmosphere.
Exactly.
Yes, the circus in 1967 was the coolest place you could be.
I guess. Or like Stan just went to a lot of circuses that summer, maybe, and it was just on the brain.
I mean, truth of the matter is, publishing of this era, especially with the era when, I mean, if you even go back to when Stan's career was starting off, probably was a lot of interaction with carny folk slash mobby type of stuff, you know? So I don't know.
The only carny we get to meet in any detail is Hawkeye, who is he's a marksman, and while he's not complete trash, he's kind of trashy. It's like, because amusement park ride starts to break down, Stark quickly changes into the Iron Man suit, rescues the people. And Hawkeye is annoyed because he had been doing his sideshow act and was getting, you know, all the attention. And then Iron Man saves the day. And he's like, I can do anything he can do. That's his big motivation for becoming a costumed hero. It's not because of some great tragedy or a desire to improve the world. It's because he wanted the same attention Iron Man gets.
Right. So he goes and builds his, like, crazy costume just to be a crazy costume. It's really refreshing to see somebody make a big weird costume and put like an H on your forehead just because you're trying to get the same attention as the superheroes. It's not like he was like, I need people to know Hawkeye starts with an H.
Yeah,
you know.
It worked for Captain America.
Yeah, it does. Daredevil does a big D on his chest.
Yep.
He also, you know, makes some trick arrows. So that's a, you know, where we start to get something more.
Right.
And he.
And none of these arrows are green. DC National lawyers take note.
He heads out to stop crimes, and he sees a jewelry store robbery and gets the thief to drop the loot while he flees. He basically shoots to not injure. Then the guy like wriggles free and takes off, drops the loot. He goes over by the loot as the police show up and just assume he's stolen it. So so they think he's the thief. He doesn't do himself any favors by just running from the cops immediately. Yeah. That is my first instinct, though, in that case.
Well, then, however, so he's running and a car happens to pull up.
Yeah.
And the person inside says, that man racing so swiftly, he might be the man I'm looking for. And it's Black Widow. So she's just trolling around Manhattan.
Yeah, looking for guys.
Looking for, like, oh, that guy's running. I could use a runner.
Get in the car.
Yep. She takes him back to the lair that her communist masters have provided for her. And she wants him to defeat Iron Man, but not harm Tony Stark. And Hawkeye agrees without hesitation because he has, like, in the space of about 4.5 minutes, fallen completely head over heels in love with her.
Her personality.
That is her superpower. Like, she is a Mata Hari type character. Yeah. So.
And Hawkeye makes some, they allude to him making some more crazy arrows, trick arrows, with some technology she has available. Meanwhile, back at Stark HQ, Hawkeye shows up, breaks into the factory. When Iron Man arrives to investigate, Hawkeye hits him with an acid arrow. It's like it starts to rust his armor.
Right.
So Stark has to remove pieces of the armor, and which I thought was pretty hilarious, just watching him sort of wander around trying to find replacement armor with like his arms off and his shoe off.
He's like half naked and like running and hiding.
I also really like that you see a close-up of Tony Stark's hands, and the dude has a giant S ring for Stark. I'm like, come on, fella. I thought there's a close-up on page 16, the first three panels, where it goes closer and closer and closer to Hawkeye's eyes.
Oh, yeah.
And the way that works it till you see him messing with the arrow. Like, this page is so amazing in terms of
this. He's, like, apparently unconscious. And Iron Man thinks he's got him. Mm-hmm. But Iron Man gets rearmored. He catches Hawkeye. This is where he sort of knocks him out on a pier. And he thinks he's unconscious. Hawkeye shoots an explosive arrow at Iron Man, because thinking that it's like a huge explosive arrow, it just bounces off of him and blows up near the Black Widow.
Yep. and he's absolutely distraught because he's completely fallen in love with the Widow.
She's the only one I've ever loved.
Like, what? It's like, wow.
It's that was quick.
Yeah, he fell real fast.
This
and
has been
real
like
hard.
6 hours, maybe. Hawkeye abandons the fight. He picks up Widow, takes her to the boat that she showed up in, heads out into the foggy night with her. Iron Man's gonna pursue them, but A, it's super foggy, and B, he suddenly remembers that they're right next to LaGuardia Airport, and he's gonna like
get in airspace. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. So he can't pursue them, so he has to let them get away, and that's basically where this issue wraps up.
Yeah, we do jump into the Watcher story.
Yes, which there is a Watcher story.
This one is a little shorter. I have to admit, like the sort of Watcher lore stuff, but I, you know, the Larry Lieber art is not my favorite. But
yeah. Well, I will say, like, each of these backstories seems to be like, how does the Watcher like come up with an excuse to intervene?
Right. When, you know, the one thing he's not supposed to do.
Yeah. I mean, you do it every issue, bud. Yeah. You know, you come up with an excuse, but come on, you know, like, what are you doing?
Yeah. So this time he does it. An invading alien force shows up on this planet. They say they're just going to loot and pillage. And there's nothing the Watcher can do.
Build a giant gun to shoot at a nearby planet,
right? Yeah. And Watcher can't do anything about it because he's got the oath of non-interference, but Watcher is just like and he like melts their gun and transports them to this inhospitable planet with these giant beasts that are ready to devour them.
I thought the Watcher lived on the moon.
That's his summer home.
Okay. they established he was on Earth's moon, so I assumed they were attacking Earth, and then he does that and they're like, nope, they were gonna shoot at my home planet.
The Watcher has like the equivalent of a stand your ground law. like all of these last few Watcher stories have basically been like the Watcher coming up with excuses to just like murder people or allow them to die.
Right.
Bad people. And let justice be done. So pretty solid Iron Man story. Good intro to Hawkeye.
And Hawkeye's not implicitly bad throughout the whole thing.
Right.
He's just jealous of Iron Man getting attention.
Yeah. And he's wildly in love from the 5 minutes of the, you know, hopping in the car with the Black Widow. He just fell head over heels.
Yeah. He's just kind of a dink. which is not the worst thing to be.
And so, it's kind of on brand for Clint.
Yeah. There you go. Cool. Well, we're going to take another break. And when we come back, we're going to dive into The Avengers on Marvel by the Month. Okay, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. We're going to talk about Avengers number 8. The title of the story is Kang the Conqueror. It's written by Stan Lee with art by Jack Kirby, inked by Dick Ayers. And as promised, this is the first appearance of Kang, the time-traveling warlord from the 40th century.
Yeah.
So the story opens with the Avengers meeting at their mansion at the request of the Pentagon. And via a closed-circuit TV connection, they're shown images of an alien craft landing in a remote area in Virginia. Army forces show up to surround it, and the craft destroys them all easily. Kang reveals himself as the pilot of the spaceship. He demands to see Earth's rulers, which is, like, that's a baller move. Like, instead of, like, take me to your leader, he's like, bring your leaders to me.
Right. And he's really nonchalant.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm not really afraid of anything that you guys have. Can you just bring the leaders, please?
Yeah.
I'm about to take over here.
Yep, thanks. Exactly.
Yeah.
So the Avengers head there instead of the leaders. They head to Virginia and they find Kang lounging on a floating chair made of air or possibly farts.
it does kind of look like it could be.
It doesn't quite. It's so amorphous that, yeah, it just looks like a cloud of farts.
Yep.
Wasp is doing the wasp thing.
So thirsty.
Immediately thirsts. Yeah. I'll bet he's not bad looking under that silly headgear he's wearing. He's got a whole mask on. Like, there's no reason to be trying to guess at his handsomeness.
Yeah. Also, she's behind him.
And Iron Man demands to know what Kang's business is. So now it's a tough guy contest. So Kang lifts everyone except Thor with an anti-gravity ray. When Thor throws his hammer at Kang, Kang redirects it by sending it into subspace.
Yeah, so he's just like, everything the Avengers are throwing it's at like, him, he's just like, whatever.
Unimaginable power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then we have some officials from the Department of Defense who step forward, and they tell the Avengers to stand down. And then Kang says he doesn't need to explain anything, but he will, but not because you told him to.
It's such a four-year-old.
Yeah, and okay, so this is the point where, buckle up, kids. This is where Stan decides to completely overcomplicate three characters simultaneously. So, all right. Kang claims that he was born in the year 3000, where he mastered time travel. Then he goes back into the distant past and calls himself Pharaoh Rama Tut, who we've already met in an issue of Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
Then he, as Rama Tut, comes forward to the 1960s, where he meets Dr. Doom, which we're going to see in Fantastic Four Annual number 2 in just a second. Then, after that meeting, he tries to return to the year 3000. He overshoots. He winds up in 4000 AD as Rama Tut. Kang says the 40th century is barbaric, savage, with men constantly at war, fighting with weapons so scientifically advanced that they cannot even understand their composition, for they were manufactured centuries earlier by more intelligent humans. So, inspired by his meeting with Dr. Doom, Kang makes battle armor for himself. He conquers the 40th century because he has the scientific knowledge from the 30th century when these weapons were made.
Right. Oh.
I think I got all that.
Yeah, yeah.
And not to jump too far ahead, because the FF Annual number 2, but is also Dr. Doom kind of, or related to?
Well,
kind
they
of
seem possibly. To think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They think he might either be Dr. Doom in the future or a descendant of Dr. Doom. That's what they're both trying to figure out.
Or he is the ancestor of Rama Tut / Kang.
Right.
The other option.
Right. Doom is...
It's the stuff gets twisted.
But I mean, like, you know, I'm sure at the time a big part of it was Stanley was, you know, doing the plotting or whatever, or the scripting on these issues.
Right.
And it just got confused. I was like, wait, what? Oh, you know.
Yeah.
But I thought it was really cool because I feel like between those two issues, and we'll get to FF in a second, but it really made me feel like this Marvel, like the Marvel universe, as opposed to just some random Marvel.
Oh, yeah. Books. And it's been around forever.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and you're part of something. And I feel, especially about making you part of something, I feel the cover copy and just the general caption copy in this issue was particularly great in terms of making you feel part of it and like including you. Like the first line of the, not including the title of the, in the issue is, "You're just in time." You know, a top priority emergency of meeting of the Avengers is about to begin. And I feel that, and we went to this a little bit last time I was around here, the difference is between Marvel and DC.
Yeah.
And I feel like DC, great comics, but they made you feel like you're seeing these stories from on high.
Yes.
Or rather, you're looking on high to these stories.
Yeah.
Whereas Marvel, I feel like, did a really great job, and I feel like it grows as time goes on, of you're in this. You're in this with us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, of course, we get in the Mirror Marvel Martian Society and things like that, but I feel like, I don't know.
Like, it's not quite fourth wall breaking because they use it in the captions,
correct,
but they do it in a way that yeah, it's totally like, no, welcome in,
yeah. Oh good, you're here finally. However, I will say this was the other issue. Here are the credits written by Stanley. Our answer to Victor Hugo, Jack Kirby, our answer to Rembrandt, all right, Dick Ayers the inker, great inker by the way, our answer to automation, and then Sam Rosen in the most insulting one yet, our answer to Artie Simek.
Whoa.
And I'm just like, dude, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, you're the only one laughing at these jokes, Stan.
Yeah.
Don't make me write them down. So anyway, Kang, we just tried to give you like a little bit of this story.
Yeah.
But he's back in the 20th century to declare himself its ruler. The Avengers aren't too keen on that, and they resume their attack. Kang holds them off and then activates an attractor ray in his ship to pull the Avengers in and hold them captive. They all get, like, put in individual little tube closets. Kang then gives the world 24 hours to declare himself Earth's monarch, or he'll destroy everything. And I believe him. But he doesn't realize that he failed to capture the Wasp and Rick Jones, which seems like, for the most part, you're like, well, what are they going to do about this?
Right. Well, we'll tell you what they're going to do about it. But first, we have to cut to the United Nations, where simultaneously every country on Earth agrees to fight against Kang together.
I thought that was a very, like, a prelude to Watchmen.
I was going
to
say, like, I literally have written down my notes. So basically, Ozymandias was totally right.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
It's like, that was
but
it.
It's funny, because isn't this all this inspired by a Outer Limits episode that has that happen?
I could see that,
where, like,
yeah,
an alien ship comes down,
yeah,
and then the world unites. And maybe, I don't remember the Outer Limits for sure, but I think even that was faked. I don't know. I'd have to look. I'd have to see it again. But.
Yeah. I mean, that tracks. Like, I totally buy that.
I mean, you know, it's Stan Lee, and later on Alan Moore, we're totally watching Outer Limits.
Yep. You know? Oh, definitely. Yeah. It's the threat that, you know, the global, the threat that will unite the world.
Yeah.
You know,
and also at the time, like, this is a tremendously wish fulfilling
oh,
for people
absolutely.
Reading these comics. Like, if you could imagine there was one thing where the world would just, like, back off from nuclear Armageddon and work together on something for once. I mean, it'd still be nice now, you know?
Like, and I didn't even expect it. That was funny. Yeah, like, reading this when it went to the United Nations, I was like, oh, here we go. Yeah. They're all just going to be like, okay, we're all down with Kang.
Yeah, or we're going to make a couple jokes at the Soviets' expense, because, like, they're the only ones who are like, this is American trick.
In fact, you know, if you really want to read too much into it, in that panel, the first nation to say yes is the Russians.
Yes.
Yeah.
They say, da, you know, before even, I guess, the Americans say yes.
And then there's apparently a British person there, because he goes, righto.
You know, and I got to say, you know, and granted, this is Marvel Comics of this era in general, but I feel like this issue, possibly even more so than any other issue that we read this month, just shows how amazing Marvel was at just relentless ideas. And I know a lot of that's Kirby, because that guy was just a new idea
just
every
constantly exploding,
day.
Yeah.
But I don't know. And it not saying, like, oh, new comics versus this, but I feel like there wasn't any, and granted, there was no nostalgia to really draw from, but it was just, I mean, could you imagine reading these at the time and, like, you didn't even know who Kang was, and this is the first time you've ever seen him?
Yeah.
You know, that's or awesome. Whatever. It's just. So wait, what happens in the next 3,000 years that Earth is destroyed?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, it alludes very subtly to, like, oh, there's something else big.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I mean, I don't know if that was intentional at all, but it does feel like, you know, he's creating this, I mean, almost like nowadays it would have led into, like, a summer crossover thing.
But yeah, right.
It's just part of the window dressing, which makes it even cooler in a way.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, Stan, I mean, he's a really good improv, if nothing else.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I mean, he's just... It's like, you know, watching, like, an old slapstick film where, like, they're laying down the track in front of the train, you know, and it's just, you know, that, like, he may not have any idea where any of this is going, but you know that all the issues that come after this, he's going to tie back. Like, continuity is a really big thing. Like, they're even, like, referencing, like, Paste Pot Pete helping the Avengers, like, dissolve Adhesive X. Like, you know.
But they do it in such a way where I don't feel confused or left out.
Not at all.
And, you know, and maybe that's another aspect we were talking about earlier about how Marvel Comics really made you feel like you're a part of Marvel Comics.
Yeah, yeah.
I mentioned earlier that I've really softened on Stan over the years, because I used to be a real adamant, you know,
I think
Kirby apologist, and I still am to a certain extent.
Sure.
But I will say, over the years, certain things have made me really appreciate him. And one is, you know, really looking at the Marvel, how Marvel was communicated to the world. And I feel you needed a Stan to do that.
The salesman, yeah.
But other thing I feel like, and this 70s Kirby is my all-time favorite Kirby, especially when working with Mike Ware. However, I will say it gets really confusing and convoluted, you know, when they go in the Fourth World stuff, especially, which, again, some of my all-time favorite comics.
Yeah.
But it made me appreciate what Stan did in the Marvel books, which is like, this guy has so many ideas. How do I, you know, make it clearer? You know, so I really appreciated him through this Kang issue, this Avengers issue, and the FF one too.
Yeah.
As convoluted as this Kang origin is, like, I don't feel like I was lost within the context of the issue.
No.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So we just left the UN.
Right.
The threat to bring the world together.
And meanwhile, Rick Jones and the Teen Brigade tell Kang they want to help him. They're like, we think you're awesome. We're on board with this whole conquering thing. So Kang just is like, all right, you get on board the ship. And because apparently lying wasn't a thing in the 40th century. So they distract Kang by accidentally breaking something he asks for.
Yeah, but also, like, they could have just been sincere in this. Do you know what I mean? Like, no shade on teenagers. Teenagers are awesome.
Right.
But I've got a nephew and I love him so much, but I would not hire him to, like, dominate the world with, because I think he would drop my nuclear bomb thing. You know, again, brilliant kid. I love him. Yeah. But I also get, like,
they're still figuring out how their bodies work.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Don't take your first really eager volunteers either. Like, interview a few people, like, work it out.
That's a really good point. You know, it's like, I've traveled millennia and, oh, there's these teenagers who want to help me out. Like, all right, come on.
Just swooped on the ship.
Sure. Yeah, he'll do.
I feel like if we were a real podcast at this point, we would cut to a commercial for some online job placement service. that'll
screen with something. Yeah, Indeed.com. So Rick figures out how to release, Giant Man first? Thor.
Yes.
So luckily, that's the other thing, is Thor is like in lame Dr. Blake form, because when he got swooped into his little container, he somehow... I don't remember. He just had to change back.
They didn't quite explain. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But he's paralyzed, so he couldn't tap his cane. So they like basically shut off the paralysis so he can tap his cane and break out, get everybody out. Then the fight is on. Everyone knows what they're in for. Wasp has been back at the lab, Hank Pym's lab, and brings this crazy weapon to Giant Man. It's some kind of power ray. I don't exactly know what it is.
Yeah, she has like an army of flying ants carrying it for her, which is pretty good. She brings it back to Giant Man. Thor is pounding on Kang's force field, both to distract Kang and also to weaken the force field. Giant Man grabs the weapon that Wasp brought to him, shoots Kang with it, and it fires a special solvent that starts dissolving his battle armor. Kang tries to blast the Avengers with radiation. He's getting kind of desperate here. But Thor, sends it back at him like he did, to Loki in the first issue of Avengers.
He can absorb it with the hammer.
Right.
And then
Kang flees and he escapes into time. And that's how our issue wraps up here. So we know that Kang is still out there somewhere, which is pretty great.
Cause he pulls like, I don't know, 12, maybe more weird, like, defenses out.
Oh, yeah.
And powers in this. So, but it is a great example of the team starts to really work like a team.
Yes.
Like Avengers isn't just, they're not just falling over each other.
But it seems like a natural transition, because they're not like amazing, but they're a little better than they were before.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's such a cool, I mean, we're what, 8 issues in, you know? So it's cool to actually see the natural progression of, oh yeah, we do not belong together in issue number 1.
Yeah,
right. Versus now we've got it pretty tight.
We know what your powers are. Maybe it's time for you to jump in while I block this thing. And
a lot of, again, I don't want to sound like, oh, back in the day, but you know, I will feel like a lot of comics now, especially like super newer superhero stuff, and I don't even mean Marvel and DC, I just mean in general, start off with, all right, this guy's established, they already know what they're doing. You know, it's one thing I really liked about Invincible, the Ryan Otley and Robert Kirkman, Corey Walker's book, was the first year he didn't know what he was doing.
You know what I mean?
And I feel like they have the element of that in here. So it's pretty cool to see that play out.
Yeah. And I think Cap joining the team is the tipping point. Like that's where things start to kind of come together a little bit. And it feels more like a team and less like a bunch of, you know, Marvel solo stars all thrown together in one book.
And they kind of attribute that to Cap. And I think that becomes more even over time.
Yeah, but, I think so. Yep.
Cool stuff, man. It is. It play out.
Yeah. All right. We got one more issue, and I think we've saved the best for last. We're going to take one more break. When we come back, it's going to be Fantastic Four Annual number 2 here on Marvel by the Month.
Now I must hide my face from all mankind, but he will pay. Oh, how he will pay.
Okay, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. It's time to talk Fantastic Four Annual number 2. In the first one, we had Namor invading Manhattan, which was pretty great. I think this one might top it. There's a couple sections of this in the original comic that we're not going to cover. There is a gallery of the Fantastic Four's greatest foes, some autographed pinups of the FF and Alicia Masters, and then a reprint of Fantastic Four number 5, where Dr. Doom first appears. But that leaves us with two amazing stories, the first of which is The Fantastic Origin of Dr. Doom, written by Stan Lee, art by Jack Kirby, inked by Chick Stone. And Joe, you were just saying during the break that this might be one of your very favorite Marvel stories of all time.
Oh, no, it is, for sure. It's my favorite Marvel origin of all time. When I read this, I always loved Doc Doom.
Yeah.
But I feel like when reading this, maybe, like, he's my favorite. I mean, to this day, my favorite Marvel character. If not, you know, my favorite combo character, tied with maybe Corda Maltese or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I think it's fantastic. And I do, you know, you mentioned Chick Stone. I think it's... Some stuff of his, you know, I will say I haven't liked as much, but this is amazing. I really feel it's one of his best works. And
yeah.
And maybe it's just because it's material he wants to do. It's very different than a typical Marvel origin.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's only 12 pages, but it feels like it's a 21 page.
Yeah. It's such a full 12 pages.
Comic. And, it doesn't feel too dense. Like, it's so well paced.
Yep.
It's the ideas are Shakespearean, which I know is the thing that people throw that term around and it never means anything.
Right. Yeah.
But it does have a caption that says, "We confidently predict that you will call this one of the greatest, most memorable origin stories of all time." And I agree.
Yeah.
And I feel it's a story that establishes my weird theory on Dr. Doom, which is that he's the protagonist of the Marvel Universe. Because every Marvel character has a major flaw. It's kind of not necessarily their undoing, but definitely the thing they struggle with the most. And with him, it's hubris and ego, which, you know, play hand in hand. And his ego is so big that it destroys the potential to save the planet, really.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And
Reed says that.
And Reed does mention
We're
that.
We're really jumping in, but yeah.
So anyway, I don't want to get too far ahead. You know, you guys want to maybe go, but we're going to be talking about this one for a bit.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, Rob, take us in.
Yeah, so we begin with Dr. Doom in his throne room, and an elderly man named Boris tells him that the time has come. Doom responds, "You are right, Boris. It is on a night such as this that she would want me to visit her." So that sounds super spooky. Boris leads Doom across a lonely, windswept moor with a lantern.
Okay, can I just pause on that panel real quick?
Yeah.
That is so cool. It's a little panel.
Yeah.
But Doom is covered in his cloak completely. It's just so spooky. It looks like a David Lean movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's so amazing.
As they walk, Doom flashes back to his childhood.
Yeah. And this is where we learn that Doom grew up as part of a gypsy tribe who once camped on that very spot years ago. Doom's father, Werner von Doom, was a healer who was summoned by soldiers to help the local baron's wife. And I just want to take a moment and say that I think Werner von Doom might be an even cooler name than Victor von Doom. It's so good. Werner, he sees that the Baroness is not going to make it. As soon as he gets back to the gypsy camp, he flees with Victor because he knows that the Baron's going to send his soldiers after them as soon as his wife dies. As they're on the run from the soldiers, they lose their horse. Werner falls ill from exposure, and Boris winds up finding them after the soldiers have left, and he brings them back to camp, but it's too late for Werner.
Yeah, and as Werner is dying, his last words are, "You must protect."
And so he has revealed that, you know, what he meant was the world, whereas Doom thinks that he means himself. And Doom's ego and his ego and hubris makes him think, "No, I don't need to be protected."
No one will have to protect me.
Said the world, he would have been like, "Yeah, I'm the best person to protect. That's probably what I'll do."
Yeah.
You know, and he, yeah, so.
Yeah.
But yeah, Boris knows that Werner was trying to say he did not mean protect the boy. He meant that the world must be protected from Victor, from the son who bears the name Von Doom.
Yeah.
Which is so cool. It's like that sets up how awesome Victor Von Doom is.
Yes. And also that this guy Boris knew it from the beginning.
Yeah.
Like he knew what he was in for.
Right.
Yeah. After Werner's death, Victor discovers that his mother had been a sorceress. And so with the inheritance, the twin inheritance, his father's medical knowledge and, you know, his scientific leanings and his mother's mystical knowledge, Victor, he's a genius. He creates a headache cure that makes a guy go bald. He creates a like a magical violin that allows the user, even if they have no skill, to be able to play it fluently. And it turns out it's just a gadget. He's hidden inside of it, and as soon as he gets away with the money, he turns it off. So he's going around the whole countryside scamming these people who remind him of the people who cost him his father.
And, and I don't know if I'm reading too much into it, but I feel like part of the implication is he could create these things if he wanted
to. He absolutely
could.
But
he's denying his genius to these guys who remind him of the guy who responsible for his father's death.
Yeah.
Which I love. I mean, being a person who always had a little bit of a problem with the wealthy elite, I like, and the money he gets, he gives to the poor too. They say so. He's just doing a Robin Hood thing, and it's so awesome. Just some smart guy scamming rich people and giving money to the poor.
Yeah, and he even demonstrates an early mastery of robotics the local aristocrats think they've caught Victor, and they put him up against the firing squad. It turns out it's just a robot dummy of him. Right. So, Doombots, man.
This is in
first Doombot.
Yeah, in a very, I can't imagine with the technology and the place they are. They're near Bavaria, I think is where they said.
Right. Latveria. In 1950s. Yeah. Yeah.
And so to see a robot that's talks appear is pretty cool. But Victor's reputation spreads to America, and a dean of science at State University recruits Victor as a scholarship student. And Boris and the Gypsy Clan remain behind in Eastern Europe as Victor heads to America to pursue his education.
And so Victor meets Reed Richards when he gets to State University. He immediately refuses to room with Reed, and that works out okay for Reed because he winds up being Ben Grimm's roommate instead. And then we've seen this bit of the story before in Fantastic Four number 5. One day Reed discovers that some calculations that Victor's making for an experiment, they're off, and he tries to warn Victor. Victor's ego will not allow him to hear that, so he tells Reed to get out. But of course, Reed was right. Doom runs the experiment and it blows up in his face, literally.
Yeah, and I have a feeling that if Reed never said anything, Doom would have been like, "Oh, I made an error. Okay, I'll fix it." But because someone else said that,
he's
like, "Okay, no, I'm definitely right now."
Yeah,
right. And that again becomes his undoing.
Yep. So Victor gets expelled from State University for the reckless and dangerous experiment. So Dr. Doom is not actually a doctor at all.
Mr. Doom. So Victor, with his face scarred, wanders to Tibet, where he's taken in by a mysterious order of monks. Somehow he winds up becoming their master.
And that's something between these two panels. This is on page 10. It's between panels 6 and 7. So he's taken in by the order of monks. He's like at death's door. They bring him into this cave. And it says, "And there he stayed month after month, learning their ancient secrets and lore, until the day came when they addressed him as Master. All is in readiness for you."
Yeah,
it's like they don't tell you
there's a whole
how this
there.
Happened.
Yeah,
but yeah.
They help him fabricate a suit of armor and a sinister metal mask. Victor orders that the mask be put on his face before it has completely cooled, because that's what a badass does. And he says, "From this moment on, there is no Victor Von Doom. He has vanished along with the handsome face he once possessed. But in his place, there shall be another, wiser, stronger, more brilliant, more powerful than ever before. From this moment on, I shall be known as Dr. Doom."
I mean, come on, man.
Yeah.
How cool is that? Again, give Stan credit. That is some cool dialogue. And that sets this guy up.
It's like he's like so much cooler than Darth Vader, you know, such an iconic villain. But also this story establishes him instantly more rich of a character.
Right? Yeah. And so Doom leaves Tibet. He begins his war against Reed Richards and the Fantastic Four. And the rest is history. And the story ends with Doom and Boris having arrived at their destination, which was the half-hidden tombstone of his father and mother. This is also the first time at the end of the story we learn that Doom is the monarch of Latveria. It's the first time that's shown up. But I think this is kind of interesting to think about. Like, what does it say about Doom that he's conquered the land where he was born, and he's transformed it completely into his image, and his parents' gravestone is still overgrown by weeds on some anonymous moor? You know, like, it's private. This is not
his hidden past.
Yeah. It's like he will honor it in his own way, but this is not a part of Dr. Doom. That's Victor, you know?
Yeah.
And I do think it speaks to him in a way where, you know, the one thought balloon we get of one of the Latverians is, ours has been a prosperous land since he has ruled us.
Yeah.
And so the implication is, no, he actually is doing a better job. I mean, granted, it's a total tyranny.
right.
But, yeah, you know, it's not only can I conquer this land, but I will do a better job than you've ever done.
Yeah.
I feel like that's Dr. Doom.
Yeah. He's a beloved tyrant.
Yeah. And the fact that there's no resistance in Latveria, he's actually able to live up to his potential. It's when he goes in the outside world and there's Reed Richards.
Yeah.
That becomes his undoing.
Right. Yep. Amazing, amazing story. And all in 12 pages.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. That's phenomenal.
So last story we're going to cover is the final story in this annual, The Final Victory of Dr. Doom, which was written by Stan Lee with art by Jack Kirby, again, inked by Chick Stone. We'll go through this one a little bit more quickly because it is more of a straight up Fantastic Four versus Doom. It's a good story. It's just, you know, doesn't have necessarily the historical weight of that origin. So this one actually, I think, chronologically takes place before the Fantastic origin of Dr. Doom, but I don't think it's super important, you know, chronologically where it all fits in there. So first off, what happened to Doom after Ben Grimm chucked him into space after that bizarre last encounter from Fantastic Four number 23? Well, he just happened to wind up right outside of Pharaoh Ramatut's time and spaceship, which he had escaped in at the end of Fantastic Four number 19. So good coincidence there. They compare notes. Ramatut says that Doom is his ancestor. They somewhat improbably wonder if they might be the same person, which I didn't quite understand how that all fits together. But anyway, Ramatut winds up sending Dr. Doom back to Earth, while Ramatut proceeds along to the future and winds up becoming Kang the Conqueror, as we saw in Avengers 8.
Hold on, so I'm just looking at page 5 here, and Doom says, or perhaps during one of your trips to the past, you became the gypsy who became Dr. Doom. We could be the same man living different, but he was a kid.
I know.
Yeah, we just learned that.
Yeah.
I mean,
it does make me think the story was done before the last one.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was just floating in space. You know, he might a little oxygen deprivation, maybe.
And they do decide the reason why they go their separate ways is because if they are one and the same person, if either of them is slain, then the other will perish. So this is Doom like doing some crazy paradox logic. So that's why they decide to separate. And I'm like, I don't know, man. I don't know.
Or maybe he just wants the Fantastic Four all to himself. And he's just going to tell this guy whatever he needs to tell him.
See, that's a very Doom thing to do, though.
Yeah.
Like, I need to get rid of this guy.
So Doom heads for the Latverian embassy and slips in through a secret entrance. The Latverian ambassador is denying that Latveria's prime minister is just a figurehead. He says, what were you expecting me to admit? The presence of some mysterious, masked, unknown tyrant who chooses to remain hidden from the world? In private, Doom orders the ambassador to throw an official reception for the Fantastic Four. Once again, lure them in with a party.
Yep. And so when the Fantastic Four arrive, all of them except Reed are tricked into drinking a native juice drink that causes them to hallucinate.
The FF trip out, and then whatever, spoilers, I guess, for a comic we're going to talk about in 2 seconds. But then they trip out Dr. Doom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they dose him.
Like, that's no one fights. I mean, really.
They counter-dose him.
Yeah, they counter-dose him. It's like some electric Kool-Aid acid test stuff.
Yeah.
Bananas.
Yeah, but the hallucinations are great. Like, Johnny thinks he sees Ben taunting him for not having the guts to kiss a Latverian countess who seems sweet on him. Like, the hallucinations are coming from their own insecurities,
which
is also great.
But it's not like their worst fear. It's just like a fear.
Yeah.
I think Sue maybe gets a little...
So this causes Johnny, like, he tears off after the hallucination of Ben. He winds up finding the real Ben and they wind up fighting, and Ben's like, I have no idea what's going on, but okay, here we go.
And actually in the middle of that, one of my favorite references, something else, on page 13, panel 1, a woman asked, tell me, Mr. Grimm, how did you ever become so powerful? He says, well, would you believe I was once a 90-pound weakling? Then some twerp kicked sand in my face, and as a matter of fact, I'm still looking for that creep. I was like, so he used the Charles Atlas guy and got him all buff? That's so cool.
Yeah. It's also super meta, because that ad was in this comic, probably.
Yeah.
So Sue hallucinates that she sees Reed making out with another woman. When she confronts him, he just insults her.
Right.
Hallucination Reed has, like, one of the meanest lines ever. He's like, what are you butting in for? I'm busy now. Go haunt a house or something. It's like, wow.
Cold.
Yeah.
While they're fighting each other, Doom has a moment of introspection.
Yeah.
He wonders if even this victory will truly make him happy. And he removes his mask to look at himself in the mirror and totally freaks out. He shoots the mirror, makes a bunch of noises. The sound of the shot and the breaking glass snaps the FF back to themselves. So they're all like, what's that?
And maybe this kind of explains why Doom is the way he is all the time. Because like in any moment of introspection, the whole thing just crumbles.
Yeah.
You know,
like he ruined his own plan.
Oh, he ruined his own face.
That's true. Doom, man.
Yeah. So they discover Doom's involvement. They pursue him. He gets away. So then the FF return to the Baxter building, but Doom is already there. So then they battle back and forth, and then Reed challenges Doom to end this once and for all. He offers Doom a drink before they fight to the finish. Then he hooks them both up to his encephalo gun. And then we learn that the one who has the stronger mind is going to banish the other to a timeless limbo from which there is no escape. So the duel begins, and it's a lot of intense shots of Reed and Doom staring at each other.
Yeah, kind of Doctor Strange-ish.
Yeah. Just And then Reed vanishes, and Doom emerges victorious. Or at least he thinks so, because Reed gave him the same juice that caused the FF to hallucinate at the party. Doom believes that he's finally conquered Reed, and the FF can enjoy a respite from him as long as the illusion lasts, and no one's quite sure how long that's going to be. So...
thanks, LSD.
Yeah. The cause of and solution to all of our problems. So shall we dive into our panels of the month?
Yes.
If you don't mind, I will go first.
Sure.
Because mine comes from Fantastic Four Annual number 2 and from the story we were literally just talking about. And it's page 8, panel 2. This is the panel where the Latverian ambassador is denying exactly what has happened in Latveria, where he's you know, saying, it's like, what is there's no mysterious masked unknown tyrant who chooses to remain hidden from the world. And like, as he's saying it, Doom is walking by him, like out of view of the reporters he's talking to. And then he like abruptly cancels the interview. But it's just like, I love the fact that in that one panel, first of all, it's a really funny way to set that up, but it also summarizes everything you need to know. It's like, so how did Doom become like the monarch of Latveria? It's like, it doesn't matter. Here's the situation. One panel, one word balloon, we're done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And mine feeds into this, and it's pretty much low-hanging fruit from what we're talking about, but it's the annual page 1. It's like a splash page.
Yeah.
It's just setting up Doom, like, in sitting on his imposing throne. Mm-hmm. It has enough, like, tapestries and things behind to establish this castle, and Boris is coming in with the lantern, but it's, like, so imposing and somehow so tragic.
Yeah.
And it's setting up the whole story that's going to happen. Yeah. Not to mention all of the balloons that are telling us that this is a masterpiece and that it's one of the greatest, most memorable origin stories of all time.
Yeah.
Like, usually that is just normal Stan hyperbole, but it really pays off in this case. And it's awesome. Like, as you know, I don't know if you know, but I have, like, in the space that the band practices in, got like this special like black light poster of Doom. I've got the Doom action figure on his throne with the like tapestries to the side of it, and I've always been a big Doom fan too, so so this is sort of the shot that I think they inspired this action figure set I have for him.
Nice.
And I've always wondered how you can pull off the Doom costume. Then this figure really helped me go like, no, it totally works,
you know. Made me think that was the Roger Corman movie.
I know, right?
The original FF movie.
Yeah.
He loved whatever on the rest of that movie. Doom looks awesome.
Yeah.
I got to say, I agree with you on the best panel of the month. But I mean, really, everything from that first page or the first story is one of my favorite Marvel stories of all time.
Yeah.
So I just want to point out another panel, which is just a little bit goofier note to kind of wrap that section up on.
Yeah.
Which is page 3. I guess it's actually technically 2 panels, 4 and 5. Where Thing messes up a car, and so some guy from the side is like, "Hey, wait, hold on a second, I'll buy that car for $1,000." And then the guy's like, "Can you get to my car?" And it's this art collector who wants to resell these things. It made me think about that It's totally believable.
Yeah, that would happen. Because, I
mean, like, oh, what, 2 weeks ago, there was that banana painting
on the wall. Yeah.
The banana on the wall that you sold for $120. I mean, that would totally be a thing.
Yeah.
And I've never thought about that in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
Where, oh, yeah, this was a brick that fell from a Captain America fighting the Tinkerer. I don't
right.
know
why it's the yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know.
If I ever get a chance to write, like, the fourth story in a Fantastic Four annual, like, I'm going to just do a little story set here, you know, from these panels where Alicia Masters is just starting to get a little annoyed at Ben because he's just like crushing cars and like, you know,
selling art. Yeah.
Selling art like for 10 times what her like, stuff
this
is.
This guy doesn't know anything about art.
And what a fun month of comics, and what a great way to spend virtual Christmas with you guys. Joe, thanks again for joining us. We got to do this regularly.
Yeah, no.
These are always a blast.
It's always my pleasure. It's the gift that keeps on giving.
Nice.
Yeah, you know, whatever. Especially if there's a Dr. Doom thing, I'm always happy to jump in.
Awesome.
Awesome.
Whatever. You guys know how to get me.
You
yeah.
got it.
Yeah.
You got anything? You talked up the Heavy Metal issue, which is on the stands now.
Yeah.
Anything else that we should keep an eye out for?
Nothing I can talk about yet, but
okay.
I got 2020 is going to be pretty cool.
Cool.
Awesome. If half of the things they got cooking, if a quarter of it I got cooking lines up, it's going to be pretty sweet.
Awesome.
But just for now, yeah, I'm Heavy Metal Magazine.
Yeah.
And, you know, whatever on my story, just cool to be part of it. And it's a great issue overall. So,
yeah. We'll bring you, anytime you have something that is, you can announce. And especially if it overlaps with Doom. But either way, it's fun to have you. Yeah.
My pleasure.
All right. You can hit us up at marvelbythemonth.com. You can find us on Instagram at marvelbythemonth and drop us emails at marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. I think that's it.
Yeah. Happy holidays in general. Obviously,
Merry Christmas.
Yeah, we're in the Judeo-Christian traditions from where we come from.
Yeah. So, my name is Brian Stratton.
And I'm Rob Milne.
And happy holidays, everybody.
Out of all the reindeer, you know you're the mastermind. Rock, rock. Oh,